welcome, everyone, to the Mid-Atlantic Championship Podcast, the podcast that travels back into time to review classic episodes of Jim Crockett Promotions' Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling program as they appear on the WWE Network. I am Mike Sempervivi, joined as always by my co-host Roman Gomez, and this is episode number 36. And in this edition, we'll be taking a look at the Mid-Atlantic television program that was taped on Wednesday, September 22nd, 1982, at the WPCQ Studios, Channel 36, in Charlotte, North Carolina, and began airing in local markets beginning the weekend of Saturday, September 25th, 1982. If you want to follow along with us as we review these shows, you can do so by signing up for the WWE Network at wwenetwork.com. You can also follow along by the way of David Taub's write-ups of the network shows, which are available over at midatlanticgateway.com. We also have social media on several platforms. Search at Mid-Atlantic Pod and look for the logo. Most active on Twitter, although there is a Facebook page, a group, and more. And without any other further ado, I want to bring in my co-host, Roman Gomez. Roman, how are you today?
I'm doing good, Mike. Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. And I'm going to vary from the script here a little bit and do something we don't usually do, which is bring up current events. As we record this show, I will reveal to you that it is Saturday, February 6th, 2021. This is the day after Hacksaw Butch Reed passed away at the age of 66. He had suffered two major heart attacks and unfortunately passed away on February 5th. Hacksaw Butch Reed was one of my favorite wrestlers growing up. When I had a chance to see him for the first time in Mid-South in 1984, and my love for him would continue on through the Natural in the WWF and then into WCW, where he looked like he would be a part of the Horsemen for a minute before floating around a while and then ending up in the Team of Doom with Ron Simmons, a incredible team who had some incredible matches, some incredible physical matches with teams like the Steiner Brothers and the Samoan SWAT team. And, you know, Butch Reed was a great, great pro wrestler, Roman, and I know you have some memories of him as well.
Yeah, I was always a big fan of Butch Reed. You know, when I first got cable, I had access to the Superstation and watched Georgia Championship Wrestling, and Buzz Sawyer ran roughshod over everybody in Georgia. And, you know, this Butch Reed guy comes out and he's, you know, challenging Sawyer. And then he did one of the unthinkable. He actually beat Buzz Sawyer in the Omni on Christmas night. And Buzz had to get his head shaved. And it just really made Butch Reed seem like a badass, you know, like, man, he beat Buzz Sawyer. And he was just a tremendous talent. And those of you that are followers of the podcast may recall, I mentioned a few shows ago, I thought he should have been the very first black world heavyweight champion. Reed could talk. He could work as a heel or as a face. He had a great look. He was, you know, athletic. And you know, I just remember in Georgia, he was always talking about Soup Bone City, and he would put his fist up, and you would not want to get hit by Butch Reed's fist. You know, he was just a badass, very credible guy. And, you know, it's a shame that the WWF didn't use him right, but what a talent. And, you know, great tag team in Doom. And to me, that was a tag team that got split up too soon. I mean, they could have been, you know, probably legendary status. You know, it may be a little extreme to say that, but they were a solid tag team. And very sad news to hear of the passing of Butch Reed. So condolences to his friends and family, and just very sad news in the wrestling world.
Yeah, from 1982 to 85, you know, arguably one of the top 10 wrestlers in the world. I think it's as far as being a total package goes, I don't think that's going too far out of the way to say. And I think that, you know, people who grew up in Florida at that time and saw what he was doing with Ric Flair may actually agree with that statement. And, you know, was great everywhere he went. As you mentioned, you know, St. Louis, he was out of Kansas City, Mid-South, obviously, where his legend was huge because of the feud with the Junkyard Dog. When he turned babyface again, the stuff with he and Buddy Landell and Skandar Akbar and bucking against them. His part, and I put this up on the Twitter page because one of the most famous hours in professional wrestling history is the edition of Mid-South Wrestling where Dick Murdoch and Ted DiBiase pull the switch because Murdoch is upset that DiBiase is getting the title shot against Ric Flair on television. That title shot, I believe, was supposed to be Butch Reed's. who had pinned Ric Flair the week before. And they go through all of that and they talk about, you know, Hacksaw Butch Reed and how he and Hacksaw Duggan are going to extract some revenge out of Dick Slater. But as that is going on, you know, we always remember the main part of the show, which is Murdoch and Flair and DiBiase, but we forget, you know, the part that Butch Reed played in that and the promo he got vowing revenge. So if you're interested in that, that's up on our Twitter page. The full episodes of that show are also up in the WWE Network. And, you know, this is where the network is a blessing and a curse. Because it's a blessing because there is so much available from Butch Reed on that network where if you wanted to go back, you can watch Mid-South and see it. You can watch his time in the WCW and see that there. But unfortunately, all of that Florida footage that they own, you know, all that great stuff where it was, you know, Butch Reed and Ric Flair and all the bad guys that Butch Reed would be bucking up against down there, especially in 1982. And then, you know, obviously that continued on. I mean, that feud with Flair, he kept getting title shots into October in 82. And then I think he went maybe to Georgia after that. But, you know, all of that stuff is owned by the WWE Network, you know, by the WWE, and unfortunately isn't up there. And it's just, it's frustrating sometimes. But at least we get a little bit of that great stuff up there. We get Doom against Ric Flair and Arn Anderson, Doom against Wyndham and Arn, Doom against the Steiners, like I mentioned. Some of that stuff was fantastic, and I understand that, you know, him coming to the WWF and being the natural Butch Reed, it was very jarring to me too. But I tell you this, I was greatly entertained because he was still Butch Reed. He was still that trash talker Butch Reed. He just happened to have some blonde hair with him and Rufus R. Jones' son dancing behind him. And you know, to watch Slick dance behind Butch Reed as Butch Reed hammed it up and the one-man gang would be hooing in the corner before he turned Akeem. You know, it was still seriously entertaining to me, even though I wished those guys were back in Mid-South. But R.I.P. Butch Reed, just a legend and maybe somebody that never makes the Hall of Fame, but he's one of those guys like a Jerry Stubbs and Arn Anderson, a Greg Valentine, you know, guys on that level that My youth absolutely would not be complete without.
And one other thing, if I can mention real quick, Mike, for those of you that aren't real familiar with Butch Reed, if you get a chance, look up the heel turn against the Junkyard Dog. That was legendary in the Mid-South area. That in Tar and Feathering. You know, anytime Butch Reed was involved in Tar and Feathering somebody, like, it was just great stuff. And yeah, like I said, condolences to the family. It's seemed to come out of nowhere. You hear he had a heart attack and then bam, he's gone. You know, it's really heartbreaking to hear the passing of Butch Reed.
Very sad indeed, but we must get to our order of business for today, which of course is the Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling episode, which aired on September 25th, 1982. And you know, Roman, sometimes we have hot angle shows. Sometimes we have hot match shows. Sometimes we have pure maintenance shows, which tend to be pure torture sometimes, as we're in the middle of a bunch of things. But on this episode, it is a angle-driven show with a direction being formed in many different ways. And we find that out right off the bat on this episode as you try to watch it on the WWE Network, because there's no opening. There's no opening to this. It is just, we jump right into Dory Funk Jr. being involved in a match against Mike Davis, which is for $100,000. And there's a lot of this on this show. There's a lot of angles and things that are taking place, and we're not exactly sure what's going on with them.
And, you know, we had talked before, Mike, about how we like when things at least seem believable. And to me, $100,000 if you pin Dory Funk? I just thought that was a little absurd. And, you know, there's a point where Bob Caudle's holding up the check and it was hard to read the check. You know, they were trying to make it seem credible. I guess there's $100,000 on the line. But the caveat was that Mike Davis had to pin Dory within the first 10 minutes. But I just thought $100,000 seemed like an awful lot of money.
I mean, wasn't that the overall prize for the World Tag Team Championship Tournament was $25,000? Or maybe it was each individual one. But still, you know, guys are getting injured. Sergeant Slaughter attacked Wahoo McDaniel. I think he was fined like, you know, what, $1,000 or something like that. So, yeah, you got Dory Funk Jr. out here in a match that for us viewing it on the network comes in ice cold. Now, as the match goes on, Bob Cottle talks about he told us earlier on, referring to something that Dory Funk Jr. had said, which means the show must have opened in real time with a Dory Funk Jr. promo. We missed some sort of production that happened where this $100,000 check was turned over to Bob Cottle to hold for this 10-minute match with Mike Davis.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of weird how they joined the match or how they went straight to the match. Because, you figure there would have been a promo of Dory, like, I'm so great, I've got so much confidence, here's a check for $100,000 for anybody to beat. At least something to kind of explain it. I thought it was kind of weird that they went straight to the match.
And the match doesn't go on for very long. It only goes on for about 4.5 minutes. And the catch with this challenge is it's a 10-minute time limit. So much like it's almost like an NWA TV title match, it's a 10-minute limit for you to try to win this $100,000 from Dory Funk Jr., who we are basically seeing on TV wrestling for the first time. We know, as we look back in hindsight, that he had become the booker. And he was still doing things in Florida and other places, but he was now, quote, working the East Coast and trying to get a heavyweight championship shot against Ric Flair. And I cut out three separate comments from Bob Cottle during this match, which, when they're over, we will talk about how it finished.
Well, we heard Dory Funk Jr. earlier as he told us he's on the East Coast now, and Dory Funk is really going to be heard from. And what a way to begin to be heard from in a special match as you put up $100,000 against the challenger. Another tremendous forearm blow by Funk, and that one floors Davis. He covers him with a press again on the account of one, and Mike Davis kicks out. It's sort of shaky to stand around and hold a check for $100,000 in your hand, but that's exactly what we've got right here, signed by Dory Funk Jr., made out to Mike Davis. 100,000 big smackaroos. Well, Dory Funk Jr. told us prior to the match that Elvis Presley had Colonel John Parker, Muhammad Ali had Don King, Wahoo McDaniel, Steamboat, and Jay Youngblood have Mid-Atlantic Wrestling behind them. Oh, a count of two. Almost had that $100,000 right there. Funk says that he will promote himself with his Texas bank account. That's what he's doing right here with a $100,000 check in our hands right now.
So there you hear Bob Cottle talking about what Dory Funk Jr. had told him earlier on, his Texas bank account, rubbing it into all those hillbillies out there in the Carolinas, his big money down there at the Double Cross Ranch and the Funk family. And basically a minute after Bob Cottle stopped talking right there, the end came when Dory locked on the spinning toe hold and Mike Davis tapped out. This match was basically a whole line of European uppercuts, which landed very hard against Mike Davis.
Yeah, you know, there was a couple things in this match I liked, Mike, and one was that Bob Cottle did mention that Dory Funk was a former NWA World Heavyweight Champion. Now, you and I know that, most of the fans know that, but if you put yourself back in time, if that was your first time watching wrestling and you put it on, you might be thinking, who is this guy putting $100,000 on the line? Like, what's his credentials? You know, so I thought that was cool that Bob did actually mention he was a former NWA heavyweight champion. And you had mentioned the uppercuts. I really liked the way Dory threw his forearms. They were very snug. They connected, very believable. And it was a short match. And this definitely was a good showcase for Dory.
If you had to pick somebody that would have been the flag bearer for Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling throughout the mid-80s, there were a lot of them. And obviously, Ric Flair is one of those people. But Ric Flair was a traveling world champion. But there was one constant in Mid-Atlantic for a long, long time. And of course, that constant was the boogie-woogie man, Jimmy Valiant. Well, Roman, we've got some bad news. He loves his music. We know he loves his music. And when he lost his music, it was a very, very big deal. He had a small red portable cassette player that he would walk around with, and it made him very upset when the House of Humperdinck stomped that into the ground. But then we got joy last week. We got joy because all of his friends, Ricky Steamboat, Wahoo McDaniel, Jack Briscoe, and all the boys in the back knew that Jimmy Valiant was going to be very upset, and they went out and they bought the Boogeyman a brand new Panasonic boombox. That's pretty awesome. Well, unfortunately, tragedy has once again befallen music. As mentioned during last week's results, Jimmy Valiant has lost the NWA Mid-Atlantic Television Championship. What we will find out later on is he also lost his music. But before that, he was scheduled for a match with Jim Dalton, where he rushed out beforehand just to let Bob know the music was dead.
All right, fans, in the ring, Jim Dalton, and here comes the Boogeyman right here, Jimmy Valiant.
Let's get him a microphone over here. Jimmy
Bobby!
Valiant.
Bobby, there's no more music! There's no more music! There's no more TV title! The Boogeyman's going crazy! I eat by my music! I sleep with my music! I work out with my music! You're seeing, you're looking at a new change, Jimmy Valiant, and I'm going to start right now. I'm not going to be, you know, I've been up 72 hours. I haven't rested. I haven't slept in 72 hours. Zola Duke, I'm coming, baby, and I'm starting right now. This is the new Jimmy Valiant.
All right, and Jim Dalton is who he says he's going to start with. As in the ring goes Jimmy Valiant to bell, and Dalton comes right out.
At this point, we don't know what happened to the music quite yet, but we do know that on September 19th, Jimmy Valiant went to Charlotte and came out of it without any music and without the NWA Mid-Atlantic Television Championship, and Jim Dalton, I guess, is going to have to suffer for that, Roman. The match only goes 37 seconds, an elbow drop, and the only thing we know is Jimmy Valiant has been up for 72 hours, and I'd believe that.
You know, he has got a lot of energy for not sleeping in 72 hours. You know, I think back to last summer when I had sleep apnea, I certainly didn't have that kind of energy. And, you know, he hasn't slept in 72 hours. And I thought of you, Mike, because I could picture you telling him to watch a Mike Rotundo promo. That probably would have put him to sleep.
Maybe he got some sleep later on in the show when he heard Keith Larson's promo. But Keith Larson fell asleep during Keith Larson's promo, but we'll get to that. To that a little bit later on. But Jimmy Valiant, 37 seconds. He has lost the TV title to Joe LeDuc. And, I don't know why, and I've had to be corrected on this with people say, hey, stop saying Joe LeDuc. It's Joe LeDuc. I have done this my whole life, and it's not like I don't know the LUC, like Jean-Luc Ponte. You know, there's Luke Robitaille, the former hockey player. There's all of these ways to where I've said Luke in other ways. But when it comes to Joe LeDuc, I've always just called him LeDuc. I know it's LeDuc. I just keep doing this over and over again. I apologize for that, everyone.
You're rubbing off on me, Mike, because I always called him LeDuc. And then I heard you call him LeDuc, and I go, well, dang, maybe I've been saying it wrong all these years. So yeah, LeDuc, you know, but I think it sucks that Dalton had to take the brunt of Valiant's aggression and lose in 37 seconds. And in my notes after that match, I put boo, because you and I have talked about how we like Dalton, and for him to lose in 37 seconds, come on, they could have gave him a little more time than that.
Although, hey, look, I'll give him this, because we'll have to take a look when we wrap this up to see whether he wrestled or not on Worldwide Wrestling and the taping immediately afterwards. But 25-year veteran like this, you know, hey, if you're going to get that $50 payoff or whatever it was, you know, you might as well get out of there in 37 seconds working with a feather as opposed to working with Wahoo McDaniel, because, boy, does Ken Timms take an ass-kicking in the main event match that we got coming up.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Coming up next, Jay Youngblood and Private Jim Nelson. Jay Youngblood and Private Jim Nelson. I'm going to say that a third time. Jay Youngblood against Private Jim Nelson. Now, Jay Youngblood, we saw team up with Ricky Steamboat last week. As we have told you, unless you're in Toronto, you don't know this if you're watching in real time, that Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood have knocked off the Privates to win the NWA Mid-Atlantic Tag Team Championship. And you got Nelson in there with Youngblood. No Carnoodle to be found. I wonder where Don Carnoodle is. Well, here's Bob Cottle to tell us.
At ringside, you're looking at Jay Youngblood, the bell. Youngblood against Private Jim Nelson. One of the privates out of the Army is Sergeant Slaughter. And also, Don Knodel, the other Private Knodel, was to have been here also. But Private Knodel received a telegram from Sergeant Slaughter today, very abruptly left for Japan. Why? We don't know. We don't know what the story is. There's a big mystery about that. But Private Knodel just up and took off for Japan to be with Sergeant Slaughter. And we're most anxious to find out what that's all about.
Well, how about that? Don Knodel has been called away by Sergeant Slaughter, who has been on suspension for beating down Wahoo McDaniel. Don Knodel called away to join Sergeant Slaughter into doing something as Jay Youngblood faces Jim Nelson. Now, not to jump ahead too much, but next week, we will see Don Knodel and Sergeant Slaughter again. You could say that that was the kickoff on the road to Greensboro. But considering that the angle was placed here and we're seeing Youngblood and Nelson in the ring, I would like to officially give September 25th, 1982, this edition of Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling, the official checkered flag on the road to Greensboro.
So Slaughter sends a telegram to Knodel, you know, just hearing the telegram part just cracked me up. I was like, what, is the carrier pigeon too busy? But supposedly, you know, Knodel is with Slaughter somewhere, and Youngblood and Nelson, I thought they had a really good contest, Mike. I enjoyed this. I thought it was a hard-hitting, back-and-forth match. The crowd got into it. At one point, Nelson had the Cobra Clutch on Youngblood, and he had it on long enough for the crowd to really get into it and for them to cheer, "Go, Jay, go." And it must have worked because Jay got up to his feet, delivered some punishment, and then eventually he hit the flying body splash for the victory. But this was a very good match, very fun to watch, and I enjoy when the crowd gets into it, and they were into this match, and so was I.
Absolutely, and it didn't go all that long in comparison to some other matches on the show, and I'm disappointed about that, although obviously we're going to get our fill of Marines and Steamboat and Youngblood here very soon. But as you mentioned, that Cobra Clutch, which was set up by Nelson hitting that Slaughter clothesline, you know, that's the official setup and finishing move of the entire Marine Corps camp, is that Slaughter Cannon clothesline followed up by the Cobra Clutch. And once again, Jim Nelson involved in an angle where the Cobra Clutch gets broken. Because as longtime listeners will remember, as we go back to the beginning of 1982, we have Jim Nelson attempting to lay out Barry Windham, Blackjack Mulligan Jr., with that Cobra Clutch, and Jr. was able to break it, which led to Slaughter and Blackjack Mulligan Jr., which was a big angle towards the end of 1981, and Jr. going after Slaughter's U.S. Heavyweight Championship. So once again, Jim Nelson involved in that angle, and as we mentioned, things will blossom very quickly when it comes to the entire situation between all of those men. So we move from there to Keith Larson cutting an in lieu of promo, where we would usually get localized spots. We unfortunately did not get that, and instead we get Keith Larson. And Roman, I can go back and pull up this promo if you want. I was on the fence about playing it on the show. I decided not to. I did cut it, and I have it ready to go for the Twitter page, so if anybody wants to check it out there. But look, if you're really missing this thing, I can go pull it up right now for you if you want.
I'm good. Thank you. I know there's things in wrestling, movies, TV, where people say it's so bad it's good. This was just so bad it was bad. And Bob Caudle is just a pro. He did everything he could to try to lead him into it, but he's just not a good promo. It's just anything he says is just boring beyond belief. I mean, he looks, you know, Valiant said he hadn't slept in 72 hours, and Knodel's acting like he just came out of a coma. It was hard to sit through, and thank goodness it didn't go on for 5 minutes or anything, but wow, this was bad.
It's never a good thing when you get an extended in the promo. That's not a good thing. And he lost his train of thought twice. He had no idea where the floor director was counting him down. So the promo actually fades to black. because he goes long with it. And when it comes back up again, he is in the ring with Greg Valentine. And, well, he gets beat up by Greg Valentine. Match goes about 4 minutes. Valentine drops the bionic elbow, the big hammer elbow drop, and follows it up with the figure four for the victory.
I had no problem with Valentine dominating Larson, but I wanted to get your take on this, Mike. I just thought it was weird that they spent 2 minutes on an interview with Larson, and then he just goes out there and just lays an egg and gets beaten to a pulp, basically. And it's just like, what was the point of the interview if you're not at least going to give him a little bit of a shine or make him look a little bit decent? Like, I just thought it was bizarre to give him an interview and then just to go out and get clobbered.
Well, to be fair, this interview was in lieu of the local spots. So the only people that were really seeing this at the time were the people in the studio. And it's you know, basically done to try to give guys some practice time. And basically, I think in the case of when it comes to the Jim Daltons and the Bill Whites of the world, you know, it's just kind of, you know, get them out there to say something. But for the guys like Tony Anthony or Tim Horner or, you know, guys of that ilk, which Rocky Kernoodle slash Keith Larson was, it was just a chance to go out there and try to get comfortable in front of the microphone. But as we know, following Rocky Kernoodle for the next couple of years, that never happens. Never even comes close to happening, unfortunately. And, you know, at some point we'll get down the line to the deal in 84 where he is trying to help his brother Don get revenge on the Russians. And you got a situation where, you know, your brother's supposed to have like a broken freaking neck and you still cannot muster up the fight it takes to cut even the slightest believable promo.
Well, let's not be so modest, Mike. Let's take this chance for a cheap plug and to plug our Starrcade 84 podcast. If you want to hear a little bit more about Kernoodle and the Russians, those of you that aren't aware, we did a Starrcade 84 podcast and you can hear a little bit more about it on there.
Thankfully, Keith Larson didn't put anybody to sleep with that promo, even though Greg Valentine just about put him to sleep with that elbow and the figure four, which led to another great moment in Jimmy Valiant history. As we find out what happened to the music, we get Jimmy Valiant and Wahoo McDaniel out there. We have the tape that is played from the 19th in Charlotte where he loses the NWA Mid-Atlantic Television Championship. And we find out what happens to the boombox, the brand new boombox that Jimmy Valiant was gifted.
All right, fans at ringside right now, here is the boogeyman, Jimmy Valiant. Jimmy.
Last week, Bobby, you seen a happy Jimmy Valiant, a happy boogeyman, when the Chief and the Briscoes and the Steamboat and the Youngbloods, I mean all the boys, Redondo, they gave Jimmy Valiant a great big box, and look what's left with it. This is what's left with it, baby. I want you to roll that tape. Show all my people what happened right there.
All right, fans, we can watch this right here. Here it is, Jimmy. This is Joe LeDuc in the ring with you, right?
That's it right there, Daddy. That's the man going to pay for that radio. He's the man that's got my TV title, people. Brothers and sisters, just keep your eye on this right here. Keep your eye on the boogeyman right there. All right, boogeyman, do your thing. Do your thing, boogeyman. Woo, myself. Feeling good right there, Jack. Feeling good, baby. I got him. I got him, people. He's going down for the count. I'll tell you what's happening right now. Right now, Humperdinck's on the floor. He's got my radio in his hand, people. He's done it. He's up on the apron now. You can't see it, but he's on the apron. I can see it. I can see it. I'm yelling at Sue Sports. I'm yelling at the referee. Get my radio. Get my radio. Get my radio. He sees it right now. This is it. Joe LeDuc is beat. He's a beaten man. He's going to throw my radio. There it is right there. He dropped it. He dropped it in the ring. I go back to Joe LeDuc. All right, people, this is it right here. This is it, people. Hit me with it. Sue Sports didn't see this, people. Brothers and sisters, I was knocked cuckoo. The boogeyman was cuckoo. Now watch this. Watch this. My music. My music. No. No. I can't sleep. I can't eat. I've been up 72 hours, Bobby. I mean, I can't. I work out with my music. No. No. No! No, baby! I can't stand it. I can't watch it. I can't watch it, Chief. Chief, I can't see it no more, brother. I can't take it no more, brother. No! No! No!
Okay, I'm going to pause that right there. Because Wahoo McDaniel's up next, and don't worry, you're going to hear from Wahoo McDaniel as well. The music died. It came back to life and has now died again, courtesy of the corner post where Joe Ledoux repeatedly smashed this thing over and over again, leaving Jimmy Valiant to hold in his hand during this interview one piece of the inside of the speaker. And that's it. We'll see the rest of the boombox later being carried over the shoulder of Joe Ledoux. But unfortunately, right now, Jimmy Valiant is without music and without sleep and without food and without everything else because the music is his life.
This was absolutely hysterical. I literally popped when I watched this. I could not stop laughing. To hear Valiant do the voiceover and to cheer himself on. All right, Boogeyman, do your thing. Do your thing. I just thought that was so funny. And then he gets the sleeper on Joe Ledoux, a man that we talked about on a few podcasts back, his feats of strength, a man that cut himself with an axe on live TV in Memphis, just one of the toughest SOBs you'd ever see. Valiant has the sleeper hold. He's ready to maintain or retain his Mid-Atlantic TV title, and he decides to yell at the ref, "Get my radio! Get my radio!" And that just cracked me up. Like, that is the most important thing in life to him. That if he had a little baby boy, I don't think he would care about his baby boy more than that boombox. And naturally, the boombox came into play. He got hit, and Ledoux destroyed it in a billion pieces. And just to hear Valiant, I can't eat. I can't sleep. I mean, Valiant is, he's ready to check himself into a mental hospital because his beloved boombox got destroyed yet again. You know, he just doesn't learn from his previous. He keeps sticking the fork in the light socket. You know, he keeps coming out with the boombox with the tape players, and they keep getting destroyed. But this whole segment was absolutely hilarious. I rewound it and watched it a couple times. I couldn't stop laughing.
So the Mid-Atlantic Heavyweight Championship in the hands of Paul Jones. Now the Mid-Atlantic Television Championship in the hands of Joe Ledoux. The House of Humperdinck continues to stay strong. But there's somebody else who's looking at one of the other championships, and that is, of course, the United States Heavyweight Championship and Sergeant Slaughter, who at this point is still a thorn in the side of Wahoo McDaniel because we have not transitioned Sergeant Slaughter over yet to that team with Don Krunoodle that's going to be coming. So here's Wahoo McDaniel also talking about what it's like to have loss.
Really upset Jimmy Valiant about that, and who can blame him for that?
You know, that's his thing. The music is his deal, and the man has a hard time living without music. You know, like I have a hard time living without my golf clubs or my headdress or my car that I drive around. And that music is his deal. He works out to it. He keeps his music with him all the time, and the man is embarrassed that we gave him something and it got destroyed. And but I'm telling you, I've been in the same situation, and I'd like to show the people, you know, just the little things that happened to me. But believe me, it always comes home, and I'd like to show you this.
Listen to you talk. You want to take Don Flair? You want his belt? You want my belt? Well, there it is.
All right, Sergeant Slaughter fans, right out here. Here come the two privates, Private Knodel and Private Nelson, and they hold Wahoo. And it's Slaughter who has got that headpiece and just tearing it all to pieces and slamming it all in Wahoo.
As the holding me. Well, let me tell you something, Sergeant. Sergeant, you've been on suspension for 4 weeks. You've been gone. Now, I don't know whether you've been training or what you've been doing, but I've been here. They've had Abdullah the Butcher here. They've had Valentine here. They've been all trying to eliminate me. I've been working hard. I've been staying in shape. I've been having to wrestle hard every night. I don't know what he's been doing, whether he's been running up and down the beach, whether he's been out drinking beer, or what he's been doing. But I know for 4 weeks he's done nothing but have to think about that I've got his title. I hit him right where it hurts, in the billfold.
Right.
He got fined $1,000, and it hurt him. Now he's sent word he's coming back. I guess my knees are supposed to start shaking. Well, you see, I got a new set of feathers, because I've got plenty of Indian friends. I've got your belt around my shoulder, Slaughter, and I am ready for you anytime.
There we hear from the big chief, United States heavyweight champion Wahoo McDaniel, who knows all about loss. He lost his Indian headdress. Jimmy Valiant lost his radio again. Maybe even? I don't know. I'm assuming that the as much as the boombox may have cost, I would assume one of those feathered headdresses probably cost a lot more.
Yeah, it probably did. And I don't know if he had all the locker room chip in to buy him a new headdress the way Valiant did with the boombox.
Nah, he just stole Jay's.
But one thing I did like about that, Mike, is that, you know, it showed Wahoo was kind of like the sympathetic baby face. He can relate to Valiant. But it showed the VTR, which those of you that don't know, VTR is videotape replay. And it showed the VTR of Wahoo getting his headdress destroyed by Slaughter and the Privates. And I thought that was good because they had mentioned Slaughter was in Japan. And you don't want a guy to be out of sight, out of mind. So, you know, they kind of planted the seed about Slaughter and that Wahoo's still mad at him. And I thought that was an effective way to do that.
Plus, it's a nice little sleight of hand because we do know that Greg Valentine is going after Wahoo McDaniel. But Wahoo is still, you know, he still knows that the last time he saw Sergeant Slaughter, Sergeant Slaughter was beating him down and getting suspended and getting fined for it. So it's a nice little sleight of hand there because obviously in hindsight, we know that he shows up next week with Don Kernoodle and a completely new direction that's got nothing to do with Wahoo McDaniel. So, again, a nice little sleight of hand there. We do get to see Wahoo and Greg Valentine interact in a way a little bit later on in the broadcast. But it was now time for Mike Rotundo against Ali Bay, who I don't think we've seen for a while. But Ali Bay is back in, and Mike Rotundo is a favorite of Dory Funk Jr.'s, one of the young guys, a blue chipper that they are looking at to get some experience and to build himself up. And Ali Bay is a good guy to have him in there against, a guy very experienced with dealing with guys on the come up. We've mentioned his name in the past, and this was a way to get Mike Rotundo some TV time in the ring, but it goes for 7 minutes, and there's a lot of back and forth. And while it's very important for a young guy's career to have these types of matches, matches like this with Ali Bay, boy, as a viewer, there are a lot of things I would like to have seen more than Mike Rotundo on the defense from Ali Bay, but he gets the win in about 7 minutes with the airplane spin. This match allowed Bob plenty of time to mention some of the affairs that are getting in order in Mid-Atlantic. We got the House of Humperdinck, obviously, in wreaking havoc and in different feuds. Bob went up and down the card, recapped that, mentioned again Slaughter's telegram to Kernoodle and questioned what that whole deal could be about with him getting summoned to Japan. But as far as the match itself goes, there was nothing wrong with it. It was just a seven-minute learning excursion for Mike Rotundo going back and forth with Ali Bay.
Yeah, and one thing I noticed that I hadn't noticed before is that, you know, maybe Ali Bay was watching Kevin Von Erich or Jimmy Snuka or something. I don't remember him going in barefoot.
Always.
But, my bad. I just never noticed it. But Rotundo, you know, he showed a little more versatility in this match. Like you said, due to the length, he actually had to sell a little bit. And there was times where I thought Rotundo looked real good. He had a nice drop kick. The airplane spin was impressive because, you know, Ali Bay is not exactly a cruiserweight. You know, he's got a little extra weight on him, and Rotundo picked him up relatively easy, delivered the airplane spin. And it's cool to see the progression of Rotundo. He's very new in the business, but he looked a lot more accomplished now than he did a few months back. You can see him improving week to week, and it's kind of a neat thing to see.
Yeah, and I mean, because especially when you put some guys that are in his class, like that we've seen, like Ron Ritchie or Kelly Kaniski, you know, they all have, you know, the same type. I'm sure, you know, that everybody, all those guys were probably being looked at as possible players for the future. And you could see where Mike Rotundo already stands out from those guys. Now, not on the microphone, not like any of them were dynamic on the microphone, probably of the three. Richie, you know, who at that point would have been the most experienced, seemed to be the most comfortable on it. But, you know, Rotundo would never get really comfortable on the microphone, with the exception, I thought, of when he was in the varsity club, because that was a character I think that he could sink his teeth into more than anything else that he ever had. But he was obviously still trying to find himself. We move to our next set of In Lieu Of interviews, which come from Bill White and Ken Timms. And The reality here is, even though it was much, much better than Keith Larson's, particularly because Keith Larson wasn't in it and we had two guys sharing some of the time, it was pretty nondescript, with Bill White just basically kind of being the anchor there and Ken Timms basically ceding time to Bill White to kind of carry the deal there. They're scheduled to get in there against Wahoo McDaniel and Jack Briscoe, which they do, and Bill White starts it off easy enough. And then less than a minute in, he tags in Ken Timms, and I don't know what Ken Timms did to Wahoo and Briscoe, but he was going to be the whipping boy in this match.
Yeah, Timms took a little bit of a beating here in this contest, and something that I thought was interesting is that Wahoo had put Timms and White in the sleeper, and he couldn't finish them off. And that just kind of stuck out with me, you know, that the enhancement talent guys were able to survive a sleeper hold from an established veteran like Wahoo before Wahoo and Briscoe eventually emerged victorious.
Yeah, kind of a rest hold sleeper, as you mentioned there. And there were a couple other peculiar things. When the match began, the House of Humperdinck, Sir Oliver Humperdinck and Greg Valentine were at ringside to do a little bit of scouting, and they went scattering away when Ken Timms was thrown to the floor by Jack Briscoe, which caused Wahoo McDaniel to jump down and then post Ken Timms, threw him into the ring post right in front of referee Tommy Young, threw him back in the ring, and Jack Briscoe gets a two count out of that deal. Now, why did Wahoo throw Timms into the post? Don't know. Why was that not enough to lay out Ken Timms? Don't know. How could Jack Briscoe, a former world heavyweight champion and collegiate superstar, not get the victory here? I have no idea, but that's unfortunately what happened. And unfortunately for Ken Timms, things kept going along where he kept getting beat up here. And ultimately, he was the one that takes the fall in the match after about 9 minutes and 33 seconds. A good, solid, one-sided affair to showcase Wahoo and Briscoe in the main event of the show.
And to me, it was kind of surprising, you know, the sleepers didn't put him away, and like you said, the shot into the ring post, but to lose on a vertical suplex.
Yeah.
Something seemed kind of weird about this match. I can't explain it, but if you've seen the match on the network, maybe you people will agree, but you don't see people lose on just a normal vertical suplex in the middle of the ring.
Not unless it's Harley Race doing it. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, the fisherman suplex, yeah.
Even that, like, yeah, I'm trying to think, you know, I'm trying to think if Race was the last one, like, deepest into the 80s with using a vertical suplex as a possible finisher, because I know I had seen him do it, whether it be in the NWA, yeah. You know, whether it be in Kansas City or wherever, but it's like, yeah, it's just, it's a rarity, and there was a lot about this match, and I don't know if they had to fill some time with it or what, but I would have, you know, boy, I would have liked to have seen about... Take 3 minutes off of this and take 2 minutes off of Rotundo and Ali Bay, man, and give that to Youngblood and Private Jim Nelson. You know what I'm saying? Like, that would have been right up my alley.
Oh, it would have been up mine, too. I was thinking the same thing when I saw the Youngblood-Nelson. Like, this was a good match, you know? And you can tell by the flow of the match and the crowd getting into it and everything. And, yeah, that very last match, though, the one we're talking about with Wahoo and Briscoe, just very peculiar on certain things.
Now, what's been also a little peculiar this episode is we have not had 75 House of Humperdinck promos with Sir Oliver Humperdinck leading the charge. But we did get one big one at the end to end the show where the whole crew was out there. So everybody get ready, because here comes the house.
You know, it's a pleasure to be here today, even among people like Wahoo McDaniels and Jack Briscoe. I want to take time now to introduce the Mid-Atlantic Heavyweight Champion, Mr. Paul Jones.
You hear those people holler, zero? Zero, it's number one!
They're confused.
They don't. Let me tell you something right now. I didn't get this belt by being zero. And I'll tell you something else. Together we shall conquer the world. Apart, we will die on the vine. This man here preaches that to us every day. And together we will stay. And we will get stronger and stronger and stronger. Briscoe, you will get beat on, beat on, and beat on. And this belt will remain in Mr. Humperdinck's family.
That's exactly right. And Ricky Steamboat, you started something right here in this very television studio. And it's not finished yet, and Big Leroy's looking for you, Ricky.
Hey, you know, Steamboat, you know something, Ollie? I know what's going on right here. Yeah, that Indian ain't got enough guts, so he done, all of them got together, and then I put Steamboat up to take on the big man. Because back in Chicago, all over wrestling, baby, the name of Bad Bad, hey, don't need no explanation. Everywhere he goes, brother, he leaves a trail of bodies. And the only thing that helps Steamboat, I haven't been able to get my hands on him like I want to. But when I do get my hands on the Steamboat, it's all over, baby. He's going to be just like in Chicago. I'm going to leave that little puny body all over the ring, baby. Because one thing I learned in Chicago, and that is to survive and do it right.
That's it. Chicago style, Ricky Steamboat. Hey, get ready for it. Now, it's my dubious honor right now to present this new television title.
Word.
Look at this belt. I want you to look at this thing. Is it beautiful? It's becoming of Joe LeDuc. Joe LeDuc beat Jimmy Valiant in the middle of the ring. I've got a little piece of videotape I want everybody to take a look at right here. Let's roll that tape and take a look at Joe LeDuc beating Jimmy Valiant right here. Covers him. Referee comes over. One, two, three. The rest is history. And Joe LeDuc, you are the new TV title holder. Oh, and what is this you got around your shoulder here? What is this? What is this piece of trash, as it were? Looks like the rest of that radio.
That's Jimmy Valiant's music.
Jimmy Valiant, look at this beautiful belt. 2 kilos of gold. 2 kilos of gold because I beat you. Mr. Uppercut, take you. I can beat anybody in the world for this much gold.
Fans, that's going to do it for this week.
And there we hear from the House of Humperdinck to close the show. You may have heard it hit the floor. Joe LeDuc came out carrying the broken boombox of Jimmy Valiant over his shoulder by the wire. As soon as he lays his eyes upon the new television championship, which looks a lot like the Canadian heavyweight championship, that I'd have to double check that maybe Sergeant Slaughter, Angelo Mosca. I'm not sure who held it at the time. But that belt looks a lot like that television championship from up there, which is very reminiscent of the old NWA World Tag Team Championship belts. And for all I know, it could have been that belt, actually. And I'm going to have to go back and do a little bit of research. And I apologize, I couldn't do that before the show, because I believe the Mid-Atlantic Gateway, our friends over there, David Chappell and Dick Bourne, actually have a story about this. But yeah. So we have a temporary television championship, but didn't matter in Joe LeDuc's eyes. That was about 4 pounds of gold, 4.5 pounds of gold. I'm not sure exactly what 2 kilos actually equals out to anymore, but it was a couple of pounds to be sure. And whatever it happened to be, it was far more valuable than carrying around that broken ass radio of Jimmy Valiant's there. As you hear Bad Bad, who hugged everybody at the end, just an amazing wingspan on a man that large. He actually hugs LeDuc, Bob Caudle, and Humperdinck all at the end. Paul Jones popping in there with his Mid-Atlantic Heavyweight Championship that makes him so proud. As you hear the crowd chanting Zero, Paul Jones, still one of the bigger heat magnets in the entire territory. In fact, with Greg Valentine kind of playing the subtle role, and with Sergeant Slaughter and Dory Funk Jr. not being around, you know, Paul Jones is really, in a lot of ways, the number one bad guy in that territory.
That belt I wanted to talk about, that was my first thought too, Mike. When I saw that, I was like, I think that's the NWA tag belt. That was, at my first glance, that's what I thought. But I mean, either way, it was very impressive to look at. You know, lots of gold, real shiny. And it was a good looking belt right there. And as far as the kilos, we might have to ask Nikita Koloff on that, because if memory serves correct, he weighed 137 kilos. So he would probably know the conversion rate on that.
Yeah, there we go. That's how the show ended up wrapping up there, with the House of Humperdinck out there shouting about, especially Bad Bad Leroy Brown. And as I mentioned at the beginning, you know, this was an angle show for the most part, because we have the deal with Jimmy Valiant. Now getting the boombox broken by Joe LeDuc and him losing the Mid-Atlantic Championship. We have something going on with Sergeant Slaughter and Don Kernoodle. We have Greg Valentine, who is still out there stalking Wahoo McDaniel, but has not made a move on him yet. We've got Dory Funk Jr. now instituting this deal where, you know, 10 minutes, you get a shot to pin me, And if you do, you get $100,000. So they're moving some things forward. And of course, as I mentioned earlier on, as we get into next week, we can basically start the road to Greensboro, Roman.
And that is some good stuff coming up. That road to Greensboro is just legendary. You know, you hear about the traffic jams on the way to the arena, that the freeway was blocked, backed up, and that is great stuff. And I know they didn't mean for it to be, but do yourself a favor if you have the network and haven't seen this episode or just listening to us, watch the Valiant stuff. It is hilarious. It reminded me of that episode of Saved by the Bell when Jesse got addicted to drugs and they made it so dramatic, and then you found out it was caffeine pills. Like, boy, they made a mountain out of a molehill. And Valiant with this boombox, and, you know, I can't eat, I can't sleep, you know, and surprised he didn't check himself into a or call the suicide hotline or anything. I mean, it was just hilarious. And looking back, like, what a big deal they made out of a broken boombox.
Something tells me Jimmy Valiant was able to self-medicate to get through that one. So didn't have to call him.
There might be another reason he was up for 72 straight hours.
Yeah. By the way, where's Roddy Piper right now? We'll get to that. We'll get to that at a different time. As the rowdy one, every time he's not on a show, his presence is certainly missed, no matter who happens to be on it. But he'll be coming back very soon, very very soon. In fact, you know, Roman, before we move on to the results. If you wanted to change the channel, though, on a little bit of wrestling for this weekend, and you turn it away from Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling and you happen to turn on World Class, we've got Gary Hart, who is bragging about his boy Kabuki and the damage he can do to the uncrowned World Heavyweight Champion, as there was one in every territory. And what was happening in Texas at the time was Kerry Von Erich was on the trail of Ric Flair, and he was being proclaimed the uncrowned World Heavyweight Champion. And Gary Hart had feelings about that and had feelings about what his boy Kabuki could do to the Von Erich family.
Gary Hart and the great Kabuki. Tonight you're meeting Kerry Von Erich. I must go back to last weekend, though, and wonder if you have any plans to sort of duplicate your move against Bugsy McGraw if you can against Kerry Von Erich tonight.
You have your views about what happened last week. I have my views about
it. I had a very good view of what happened.
Just let me say this. Tonight we're going to do Ric Flair one personal favor. They're calling Kerry Von Erich the uncrowned champion of the world. Well, we're going to show everyone that Kerry Von Erich is not the uncrowned champion. It is Ric Flair who is the champion, and we're going to beat Kerry Von Erich in record time and remove the myth that has been floating around in World Class. Personal favor to you, Ric Flair, because you are a classy guy.
I don't understand your situation on that, but let's turn it back up to Jay.
So there you hear Gary Hart wanting to be fair to Flair and thinking that Kabuki could defeat Kerry Von Erich in record time. Kerry Von Erich would go on to defeat Kabuki in the next match in 43 seconds. So Gary Hart and his man not being able to stop Kabuki. And I got one more thing to play, and it comes from Memphis. In the past, we've played Jim Cornette desperately trying to hire on some talent. He went to Jerry Lawler, who laughed him off. He went to Bill Dundee, who was upset that he went to Jerry Lawler first. Well, he finally's got somebody that wants to sign on and be with him as a manager. Okay, that's not exactly true. They were hired by his mother, and that's good enough for Jim. Here's the debut of Sherry Martel in the house of Cornette.
We're going to be ready to go with our opening bout in just a moment, but we wanted to bring you up to date, as we had introduced some time ago, you folks, to Jimmy Cornette, who was interested in getting into the wrestling business as a manager. Jimmy, we've had a couple of rough sessions out here. Hopefully today we won't have a repeat of anything.
Well, Lance, today we're not going to have a repeat of anything that I've had before. We're going to have some success today because I am so happy. What have I been coming out here and telling you that I was going to do?
You are looking
for
talent.
Don't interrupt me. I have been coming out here and I've been telling you. And if these people would be quiet, you're not even going to upset me today. I'm happy because I've been telling you that I wanted champions. And today I have not one, but two champions, Lance. Do you understand that?
That you've
and I'm happy
signed.
About it. That I have signed up, and I would like to introduce one of them right now, and I'm going to bring her out.
Her
one
out.
Half of the North American Tag Team Champions, Miss Sherry Martel. And she is lovely, isn't she, Lance?
Yeah,
come on over.
Indeed. And now you.
Yes.
Sherry Martel and.
You know, the
manager,
reason
Jimmy Cornette.
That the other half of the North American Tag Team Champions, ladies' division, is not here today, besides the fact that these people couldn't take two girls as good looking in one place, is because she had to go to the hairdresser. But I assure you, she will be joining us shortly. And Lance, all I can say is, can I make an investment or can I make an investment?
I want to ask Sherry something. Sherry, I don't know, how do you feel about signing with a manager that really doesn't have that any experience in professional wrestling?
Mr. Russell, I got one thing to say. Money talks and you know what walks.
Well, I guess that ends that conversation. And, okay, Sherry Martel and Jimmy
and
Cornette.
I have my first champion in Lance. She saw my wallet, and
I get the idea. Okay, well, we're going to see Sherry in action right here. The only thing I can say is good luck to you, and good luck to you, Jimmy. We'll get a debut of Jimmy in action right here if we can break up the... That's all we got, okay, David. Hey, one thing after another.
Oh, indeed it is. Well, this match is going to be a one-fall, 15-minute time limit match. Introducing first from Dublin, Ireland, at 152 pounds, Velvet McIntyre on the right of your screen. And going against her from New Orleans, Louisiana, at 140 pounds, with her manager, Jimmy Cornette, Sherry Martel. This match, one-fall, 15-minute time limit. Jerry Calhoun is the referee.
Roman. His mother bought him a woman.
Mama Cornette had all kinds of money, didn't she?
She did. She did. You know, for anybody that goes and seeks this out, how young Sherry Martel was, and she was, I don't know if she was a champion at the time. I mean, the belts that Moolah would control actually at that time were in the hands of Joyce Grable and Wendy Richter, who you can see on some old shows from Mid-South and in different places where they had shown up to defend their women's tag team championship. And they were a very good team. There was Joyce Grable and Wendy Richter, you know, and I, cause I was not old enough to remember the Grable and Vicki Williams and some of the earlier teams there, but Joyce Grable and Wendy Richter were a fine team. And, you know, Wendy Richter was obviously tapped to go to the WWF and all, we know what happened from there, but they technically were the women's champions at the time. They wouldn't lose those until 1983 when they would lose them to Sherry Martel's opponent in this match, Velvet McIntyre and Princess Victoria. But, you know, kind of doing a little search from around the wrestling world, those were the two of the more amusing things that stuck out to play.
And I can tell you firsthand, I thought for sure Sherry Martel was very underrated.
Oh, yeah.
I used to see her in the AWA at the Showboat when she managed the Playboy and the Pretty Boy, and actually saw her wrestle. And I'll tell you, that woman could get some heat. A very attractive lady. You know, they kind of downplayed it a little bit in the WWF with the Scary Sherry. But a very attractive lady, a lady that could get heat, a lady that could take bumps. She was a good worker. She was a good manager. And something I thought of in... It's sad that it got kind of swept under the rug. Her passing preceded Chris Benoit by, not sure on the exact timeline, but it was pretty close, maybe a week, 3 days, something like that. So Sherry got kind of swept under the rug, and I kind of was hoping that they would have done a dark side of the ring on Sherry. I would like somebody to do a deep dive into the passing of Sherry Martel, but what a great talent. You know, she was very underrated.
Incredible talent. And, you know, one of the things that, in a way, is it's one of the biggest compliments I think you can pay her or somebody like a Jacqueline is they're not, you don't talk about them as far as being great women's wrestlers. Like, they're just great wrestling personalities. And Sherry Martel, what a career that she had. And then you know, for the length that it had and the impact, and she was great with everything, whether it be with Harlem Heat or with, you know, messing with Colonel Robert Parker or with Randy Savage or you name it, you know, it being the middle woman between Martel and Michaels, like time after time after time, you know, moment after moment, Sherry Martel was the person. She, like you mentioned, bumped like a mad woman, you know, bumped like a dude, you know, bumped crazier than some dudes at that time. You know, she took more bumps than Hogan did, you know, and took them from Hogan. As legend knows now, Jim Cornette's first client.
Mike, if I could just add one thing, if it's okay, real quick.
Sure.
I wanted to give a shout out to Alexis Smirnoff's daughter, Chantel. She sent me something in the mail, and one thing that I enjoy with the podcast is meeting fans and everything. And I met her at Cauliflower Alley a couple of years ago, and I have seen wrestling fans pull together. And I think it's beautiful, you know, when somebody posts that, you know, their dad may have had a heart attack or something, like, you see the outreach of people. I'll be praying for your dad. What can I do to help? And that's just something on a personal note that I've seen. And I think it's awesome that wrestling fans like stick together, and not to be corny or mushy, but it's like a little fraternity or a family. And that's something I've seen more and more of since I've been doing the podcast. And I just think it's wonderful that people stick together, especially now with all the craziness of the world. So thank you, Chantal. And I'll shut up for now.
And I'll use that time to shout out Trisha Ann, 1973 on Trisha. I know she loves this time. She always talks about it. Popping like a mad woman every time we put up some clips of Jimmy Valiant. So going to be fun to get her reaction on Twitter to some of this craziness with the Boogie Woogie Man being oh so broken up over everything that's taking place. Forget about the title. Who cares about the title? Damn it, we need the music back. But let's take a look at what happened on Worldwide Wrestling, and then we'll get to the rundown of results from around the area. Mike Rotundo and Jack Briscoe defeated Ken Timms and Bill White. Dory Funk Jr. and Joe LeDuc defeated Ron Ritchie and Mike Davis. Jay Youngblood defeated Ali Bay. Paul Jones defeated Rick Benefield. And Greg Valentine teamed up with Leroy Brown to defeat Mike Reed and King Parson.
Let's take time for this commercial message about the Mid-Atlantic wrestling events coming up in your area.
And we start on the 23rd, Thursday, Union, South Carolina. Johnny Weaver defeated Private Nelson. And Wahoo McDaniel and Jack Briscoe knocked off Paul Jones and Greg Valentine. Also on Thursday in Winston-Salem, Jerry Briscoe, Jay Youngblood, and Mike Rotundo defeated Private Canoodle, Leroy Brown, and Gene Anderson, while Jimmy Valiant defeated Joe LeDuc. Saturday the 25th in Roanoke, the Briscoe brothers faced off against Paul Jones and Leroy Brown. Jimmy Valiant faced Joe LeDuc. Johnny Weaver faced off against the Inferno. The next day on Sunday in Hampton, Jack and Jerry Briscoe defeated Paul Jones and Greg Valentine. Ricky Steamboat knocked off Leroy Brown, and Jimmy Valiant defeated Joe LeDuc. On Monday in Fayetteville at Cumberland County Memorial Arena, Jay Youngblood defeated Gene Anderson, while Joe LeDuc and Leroy Brown defeated Ricky Steamboat and Jimmy Valiant. Also on Monday in Greenville, South Carolina, Jack Briscoe defeated Paul Jones, while Wahoo McDaniel defeated Greg Valentine. On Tuesday in Raleigh at the Civic Center, Joe LeDuc defeated Jimmy Valiant by disqualification, while Wahoo McDaniel defeated Greg Valentine. Also on Tuesday in Columbia, South Carolina, at Township Auditorium, Jack Briscoe faced off against Paul Jones, while Leroy Brown faced off against Ricky Steamboat. And that takes us back around to Wednesday, September 29th, Charlotte, North Carolina, WPCQ Studios. Here's the WWE Network preview for next week. October 2nd, 1982. On this edition of Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling, Greg Valentine and Joe LeDuc take to the ring to compete against Ron Ritchie and Porkchop Cash in a tag team match main event, plus Sergeant Slaughter, Ricky Steamboat, and many more in action. As I mentioned earlier on, if you like this show and would like to connect with it more, I invite you to follow us on all of our forms of social media, especially our Twitter. Just search at Mid-Atlantic Pod and look for the logo. And also, please support all of the shows here on the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. We don't condescend, and we are dedicated to preserving and accurately archiving the history of professional wrestling. And I'm proud that this show, executive produced by me, can be a part of that. For Roman Gomez, I'm Mike Sempervivi. Take us home, Uncle Bob.
And that'll do it for this week. See you next week. And until then, so long for now.